Spanning the early colonial era to the 19th century, the new book Ebony and Ivy, Race, Slavery, and the Troubled History of America's Universities by Craig Stephen Wilder, a leading historian of race in America, lays bare uncomfortable truths about race, slavery, and the American Academy. The African slave trade generated the wealth and procured the labor that allowed Europeans to raise colleges in the colonies. Many of America's revered colleges and universities, from Harvard, Yale, and Princeton to Rutgers, Williams College, and UNC, were soaked in the sweat, the tears, and sometimes the blood of people of color. We welcome Craig Stephen Wilder to the program to talk about his new book, Ebony and Ivy. Thank you very much for being with us, Craig. I appreciate it.
Thank you for the invitation.
What brought you to this subject, to look at this link?
Honestly, I think it was just I slowly moved toward it over time. I was interested in, black abolitionists, actually, the free African Americans who opposed slavery in the 19th century. And one of the things I got interested in was how they got their education, given the fact that they were excluded from colleges. And that brought me just deeper into this question of the relationship between the historic elite institutions and these African-American communities over time.
How much of it was avoidable in the sense of the universities or the colleges that did not do what the colleges that you outline in the book did?
Well, actually, I think it's not so much that it's avoidable. I mean, part of what I argue in the book is that this is the world in which these colleges evolve. And looking at the colleges gives you a way of really thinking about just how complex, intricate, and pervasive the slave economy was. So this is the economy within which these institutions evolve. They rely upon the slave economy for their students, as a source of students, as a sources of wealth and funding, donors, leadership. And so, for me, I really wanted to get to and get readers to see colleges as a lens for understanding the role of slavery in the rise of the North American colonies and ultimately the United States.
But a point that you make in the book, when, as you note in the subtitle, The Troubled History of America's Universities, when we look at that troubled history, it still has an impact on many of those universities today.
Yeah, it does. They live with, I think all of us, we live with a legacy of slavery. And they've wrestled with these questions over time. When I was doing the research in the archives for, countless university archives for this book over many years, it's not that this history is hidden. It's there. And historians in past generations have come across much of the same evidence. I think that, for me, was a real learning experience about the way in which the profession, the scholars themselves, have struggled with how to tell this story and if it should be told.
The story that you tell is fascinating because it starts in some ways as a geographic one of how northern colleges would have this system, if you will, in place, the slave system, that then spread to the South, South Carolina, Georgia, and others.
Yeah, when I first started, actually, I thought that a lot of the book would be about the South. And, in fact, actually, the majority of the book is about the North. And in part because the Southern universities, there aren't that many colleges in the South. There's only one before, a successful one. Before the American Revolution, William and Mary is the only one there when the Revolution begins. There are already, several colleges in the North. And the expansion of the academy in the South as the cotton culture of the South expands west toward Mississippi and as plantation slavery as we know it emerges in the South, the academy expands with that. It expands on that economy. It feeds upon it, the Southern Academy. And so Southern colleges are actually very much a product of Northern college graduates heading south to establish new institutions. And I examine that pattern in the book.
as I mentioned, you are a professor of American history at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. You have taught at Williams College and Dartmouth College. Do you feel that there, while as a professor there, do you feel the tentacles of this one-time policy?
I think you do and you don't. You know, I think in many of these institutions, the history is actually kind of hidden from you. That history has been hidden from us for a long time. But I think that fact, you know, the fact that we've not wrestled with this past creates its own tension on the campuses. And so I have said in various venues, you know, these are schools I love. I've worked for them. I've taught at them. You know, I've had my greatest successes as an academic at and through these institutions, and I graduated from one of them. And so these are institutions that are actually very close to me personally. But the fact that we haven't wrestled with this history leaves a tension that we need to address. And I think when Brown University did its 2006 report on its relationship to the slave trade, it was an instructive moment for all of us. For everyone at these kinds of institutions, these sort of elite historic schools, that there's nothing for us to run from in the college archives. There's nothing dangerous in those university archives, but there are, in fact, some difficult historical realities that if we wrestle with, we'll be better for in the end.
You write in the book about the College of New Jersey and the role of that institution, along with the Reverend John Witherspoon, in the education of leaders and ultimately their successors. And I'm hoping you can give us a brief idea of the role of the College of New Jersey and how it played, because it's a fascinating exploration.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in one of the chapters, I decided to really, and it was what we were talking about earlier, how the Northern schools helped to expand and create the Southern Academy, the new colleges that emerged in the South, particularly after the American Revolution. And the College of New Jersey, which is now Princeton, is a prime example. The Reverend John Witherspoon comes at a moment when the college is really struggling. It's lost two presidents in a very short period. Two presidents have died. Witherspoon is recruited from Scotland to come take over. Witherspoon, a Scottish Presbyterian minister, has been recruited to come take over the Presbyterian College of New Jersey, now Princeton. It takes a long time to convince him to do it. He does it. And one of the ways that he really, you know, ensures the success of the college and turns around its fate is by recruiting new students, finding new sources of donors and wealth. And that means that almost immediately he begins heading south and exploiting the connections between created by the expansion of the Presbyterian Church in North America, which gives him access to the wealthy planters of the Carolinas, but also the wealthy planters of the West Indies. And, you know, within a short time after his arrival, he writes a missive to the West Indies, which is basically an appeal for both students and donations, touting the benefits of the College of New Jersey and the care that the faculty of the College of New Jersey, now Princeton, would give to their boys if they sent them north.
You use the term scientific racism. You mm-hmm. write the rise of scientific racism, like theological racism, required interventions in the academic and intellectual realms, from the passive distortions of unreliable and biased sources to the active invasions of slave traders and slave owners seeking intellectual proofs for their suspicious and assertions about the nature of color. Talk a little bit about the science of racism.
Sure. One of the things I got really fascinated with as I was doing the research for the project was the rise of the sciences in the North American colonies, and particularly medical schools, which begin getting established in the early 1760s. The first one is at the College of Philadelphia, which is now the University of Pennsylvania. And I ended up tracing the journeys of a lot of young college graduates from the colonies, from places like New Jersey and Pennsylvania and New York, to Britain. Many of them went off to Scotland in particular, and so I went to Edinburgh and to Glasgow and to England to find the places where they were studying and to look at what they were studying, what they were learning. And really, I just wanted to figure out at first what it was that they were learning, that they were bringing back to the colonies. And one of the things I learned along the way, or figured out along the way, was actually that they weren't just taking knowledge from Europe. they were bringing knowledge to Europe. So many of these young men, precisely because they had grown up in a world with slavery, in a world in which the American colonists were advancing into Native American territory, had intimate relationships with black people and Native Americans. And they brought that knowledge to Europe. Some of them actually end up giving speeches to many of the royal philosophical and intellectual societies on the nature of color in North America. And so I actually spend a lot of time actually thinking about the way in which the American colonists, when they traveled to Europe, became experts on race, on this emerging science of race, and contributed to its development.
We often think of the progressive label that is given to much of academia and to the American Academy. Do we see that come in later?
Sure. And in fact, actually, I write in the book, in the final chapters, that there's a real tension between slavery and anti-slavery on the American campus. The two things actually live side by side for much of the history of the Academy. There you can find an anti-slavery and a moral critique of slavery happening on campus at the same time that these campuses, these colleges, are exploiting the slave economies of the Atlantic world for money and for students and for governors, adding slave traders to their board and simultaneously actually hosting debates about the morality of slavery. And part of that is the dynamic tension of the Atlantic world and the way in which ideas flowed in the 18th century world. I was fascinated by that phenomena of these two different debates happening at once and often living side by side. So you're absolutely right. You know, there is certainly by the time of the American Revolution a very intense questioning of the morality of slavery on campuses that still have close connections to slavery and the slave trade.
I do want to pick up on something that you noted earlier, that this history is not apparent and often hidden on the campuses and by the universities, and I suppose you can certainly understand why. Why do you believe it's important to embrace it and to understand it more fully?
I think, you know, the Academy, as the former president of Brown, Ruth Simmons, who commissioned the investigation of the relationship between Brown and the slave trade back in 2003, which resulted in a 2006 report, as Ruth Simmons pointed out, you know, academics have a moral obligation to pursue truth. We have a moral obligation to ask difficult questions, to explore them. And really, in fact, the job of a historian, if I can talk personally, is to take up difficult tasks, take up difficult questions, and help bring readers through the process of understanding this past. And I think the Academy is an important place for doing these kinds of investigations because it provides really a quite new lens on understanding just how significant slavery and the slave trade were to the rise of America and its institutions.
So I guess the question is, with that lens, do we do something with it, or do we recognize it as a lens, or do we actually use another lens and now see things more clearly and differently?
I hope that people will see it differently. You know, I don't have a prescription for each institution of what they need to do, but what's been fascinating is actually watching, especially after 2006 with Brown, the number of universities and colleges who have begun to explore this history on their own campuses. You know, their faculty teaching courses, their graduate students doing websites, their undergraduates doing their senior theses. Some of the college museums have actually done exhibits on slavery and the history of their own institutions. And then some of the institutions have actually taken action at the level of the executive officers and the trustees to respond to some of this history. And I think that's actually been an important development because it gives us a new sensitivity to the reality of slavery in the history of our nation, but also in our own proximity to this history.
When you were researching the book, how did you find the history to be present when you started digging? Was it apparent? Was it easily apparent, or was it something that you really had to dig for?
Well, you know, I think there are a couple of ways of answering it. And the first one is, you know, historians often look at all the secondary sources, the published sources first,
right,
to figure out what's out there. And I did that. And, you know, in the histories of the Southern universities, Vanderbilt and William and Mary and Wake Forest, There's a lot more about slavery in those histories. It's, you know, often it's not, you know, a gentle portrait of slavery or a balanced portrait, but that history is actually acknowledged. In the northern campuses, there's less actually in the published accounts on the history of slavery, especially in any real narrative form. But once you get into the archives, into the president's papers and the diaries of the faculty members and the lecture notes of the students and all of those documents that remain from the 17th, 18th, and early 19th century, you actually begin to see a really quite three-dimensional portrait of the way in which slavery shaped the lives of students, faculty, and administrators. There's a lot of information, actually, on slavery and the slave trade. One of the reasons why it took me so long to finish the book, you know, it was more than a decade of research, was in part because there was so much material.
And with that material, I assume you is it overt, is it obvious, or does it take a special eye to look and see of what is being explained? And
no, it's pretty straightforward. You know, the diaries of some of the presidents, for instance, at several elite institutions include notes about the purchase and sale of slaves for their households. The minutes of the trustees often include information about donors and the pursuit of wealthy donors in the plantations of the South and the West Indies. The records of the trustees and the boards will include disciplinary records and reports on students who are caught violating certain kinds of codes, often, in fact, using enslaved people for various kinds of entertainments, from boxing to drinking to dancing. And so it's actually pretty overt. You go through and, you know, the names of the enslaved people are there, and some glimpses into their lives on campus and off campus are there. But even more significantly, you start to get very quickly a portrait of the way in which slavery shaped the histories of these institutions, both as the slave trade shaped it, but also as enslaved people on campus contributed to the rise of this academy.
The book is fascinating. It is Ebony and Ivory by Craig Stephen Wilder. Craig, I want to thank you very much for being with us and sharing your knowledge with us. A great pleasure.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Again, the title of the book is Ebony and Ivy. It is published by Bloomsbury Press. Ebony and Ivy by Craig Stephen Wilder. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.